In just a moment, Keys to the Capitol. But first, Monitor, going places and doing things this weekend, all weekend. Yes, from early Saturday morning to late Sunday night, Monitor, NBC's big new radio service, keeps you in touch with the entire world, filling your idle hours and busy hours with entertainment. Monitor is as near as the radio by your side. Why not make this weekend a very special time of travel, fun, and excitement with NBC's Monitor? And now, stay tuned for Keys to the Capitol on NBC.
What's going on in Washington?
On how many years in school, it all depends.
Now it's guilt by kinship.
Who'll go for the Democrats?
Moscow, the new tourist mecca.
NBC News presents Keys to the Capitol, a program of informal discussion of the issues and problems of today's national news. Listen now as four of NBC's Washington reporters take you behind the scenes in Washington. Tonight you will hear David Brinkley, Richard Harkness, Arthur Barrio, and Bill Sprague. Here, transcribed from Washington, is Keys to the Capitol. First, here is David Brinkley.
Last Sunday, President Eisenhower was in Colorado inspecting the new Air Force Academy and being shown around what buildings they had, the temporary buildings they have now. And in the middle of this inspection trip, delivered himself of what apparently was an offhand, off-the-cuff comment on the subject of education. And it has created a good deal of discussion and some controversy in the three or four days since then. What he said was that nowadays, living is so complex, so complicated, and so demanding, that he thinks it would be a good idea if high school courses were extended to 5 years and college courses to 5 years. Well, the general in charge, General Harmon it is, the commanding officer of the Air Force Academy, was with him at the time, and so far as I know, he didn't say anything about it. But since then, a great many people in the educational field have. I certainly pretend to know special qualifications on this subject, but I have talked, since we decided to discuss this, to several educators around town here at the NEA and in other places. I have asked them what they think about it, and an opinion I keep running into, and it seems to make sense, I'd like to hear what you think about it, is that you just cannot make any flat general statements about how many years a young man or young woman should spend in school. Because the people themselves are so diverse and the subjects, the courses of study they go into are so diverse that you can't make any flat rules. One man I talked to didn't want to be quoted for political reasons. He said you can in college get a course in interior decorating or in physics. And it's rather obvious that one would take longer than the other. So you can't make any flat rules about how many years. Some courses take longer than others, and some people take longer than others. And another problem, particularly relating to high schools, is that we can barely, if at all, pay for the ones we have now. We don't have enough classrooms. We don't have enough teachers. My six-year-old is going to school half day right now. If we extended the schools another year, that would mean, a 20 or 25%. I'm not very good at arithmetic. There's a commentary on schools for you. would require more teachers, more classrooms, and so on, which we don't have enough now for 4 years. On the question of money, which always lies at the center of any school controversy, we're short of money now for teachers' salaries and school buildings. We're in the middle of a big controversy about whether or not the federal government should help schools. It's pretty expensive now to send a child through a four-year college course, and presumably would be even more so if you sent him through five. What thoughts do you have on this subject, gentlemen? Richard, what do you say? Well, you have three boys, don't you?
Yes, and Mrs. Harkness wishes instead of 9 months a year, they went to school 12 months a year. I'm sure of that. But isn't the trend toward what the president was talking about, David? Anybody who's going into any kind of specialization these days, the professions, the sciences, all of the skill fields, so-called, are now taking, well, at least 3 years of general college and then going to what amounts to postgraduate. They go into law school, medicine, they take a PhD. Yes. So I think what the president is driving at is really coming about slowly. Now, whether we should revise our whole high school courses and make those 5 years, perhaps it should if a student isn't going on. Whether we should make all our college courses 5 years, I doubt if we'll do that. But what Mr. Eisenhower says is basically true. And actually, our education system hasn't been revamped for, well, I suppose since the days of McGuffey's readers, really. And it's perhaps it should be that a commission ought to take a look at it and see whether we shouldn't revise our courses, the length of school and everything, and because of this specialized, mechanized age in which we live.
You mentioned the need for revamping. Just a second, Arthur. This one educator pointed out to me that this 9 months of school and 3 months of vacation is, as I guess everyone would know if he thought about it, a hangover from the old agricultural days in this country when the kids were needed in the summer to help work on the farms. He says that is no longer necessary in cities, and it would seem to me it's not. Arthur, what did you start to
say? I was going to say, I thought the president had in mind, but did not say, these specialized fields you've been mentioning, such as medicine, law, and engineering. Undoubtedly, in those, you need 5 years or even more. But I fail to see where, for example, if a man is taking a liberal arts course, he would need more than 4 years of it.
He may even need less.
Less, that's right.
Well, I think the president had another thought in mind, which was expressed either directly by him or by some commentary on the subject, to the effect that in these times when the span of life is getting longer, the population getting bigger, that the keeping the younger people in school for a longer period of time would create more opportunity for the people who had passed the school age and were getting up past middle age. That it is, of course, I feel very strongly that trying to establish a five-year system in view of the shortages that exist in the educational system now are quite premature, but this, I think perhaps from a long-range point of view, that was one of the things that was in his mind.
Well, there's a further fact that most young men nowadays have to go into the military services for a couple of years or so.
Well, I don't think that's quite true, David. I don't know that most men do by any means with the current draft calls and enlistment quotas. I don't believe that even a major percentage of the young men, let alone the young women, are doing military duty as it comes along. Now, that some temporary crisis might change that.
Yeah, well, they will, in effect, though, under this new law that's been passed, the so-called Training Act, most of them will. I think one point to remember here, that President Eisenhower himself is a highly trained man in his particular field of the military, not only his 4 years at West Point, but staff school at Leavenworth, National War College here in Washington. And so he speaks with a certain amount of knowledge that you do continue your education and need more of it.
Well, I'm sure he has continued his as long after having left his classrooms.
David, for a complete shift in subject matter, as all of you gentlemen know, the government's Loyalty Security Program has been in and out of hot water ever since President Truman launched employees' checks back in 1950, and ever since President Eisenhower widened the scope of the program when he came in 1953. Now, at first, criticism of the program revolved around the charge of guilt by association. We heard a great deal of that. Now it seems that a new allegation has risen, guilt by kinship. That means that if a person's mother or father or brother or sister is a security risk, if any of the family might be classed by some federal security officer as a security risk, well, out goes that government employee, although the employee individually may be a member of the American Legion, the Epworth League, or even the Union League Club. Now, this guilt by kinship has been no hypothetical charge. For instance, just current in the news, there's the graduate of the Coast Guard Officers Candidate School, that young man, Norman Pierre Gaston. He was all set to receive his commission. Then it was discovered that his mother, not the boy, but his mother, had been a member of several organizations on the Attorney General's list of so-called subversive groups. So young Gaston had his commission withheld because he was a security risk, or so the security officer said. Now, this one story happens to have a happy ending. The Coast Guard finally decided that Gaston should be judged not by his mother's political leanings, but as an adult in his own rights and should stand on his own merits, so he's going to get his commission. Now, I think it's very clear, despite the Landy case, one or two others like it, that cases such as this Gaston incident, that they're exceptions. Now, Mrs. Harkness and I have just spent 6 months studying the workings of the Loyalty Security Program. Our first article on the subject, if I may get in a commercial plug right here, if you please, is in this current Reader's Digest. Now, certainly there was, and there is, a need for the government to check workers to keep out communists. Just one example of that, the chairman of the House Un-American Activities Committee, Representative Walter of Pennsylvania, says that his group now has evidence that a communist cell operated in the federal government as late as 1954. So it is a red aim to infiltrate, to penetrate the administration. In a great majority of cases, I think, the Loyalty Security Program has and is working fairly. But every case such as this Gaston case that I mentioned is a danger sign, I think, to all of us. It's a warning that when the government starts delving into any individual's associations, his talk, or even his relatives, that we'd better be very sure, all of us, that we're having our individual liberties protected. Gentlemen, what are your views on the Loyalty Security Program?
Well, in this Gaston case, I might say, Richard, I thought one part of the Coast Guard's finding was a trifle ridiculous, where they said that there was no close association in the later years. I thought that was going a little too far, drawing it a little too fine.
This is between the boy and his mother.
Between the boy and his mother, yes. Seems to me entirely ridiculous. I don't see why they don't, why they can't, base it on the reputation and on the conduct of the man himself. Certainly no one is responsible for his birth. That's
one of the things we live by in this country. I think the reason this guilt by relationship thing has come about lately in the services is that they are all gun-shy and hypersensitive on this subject. Having seen what happened to the Army a while back when it had a dubious loyalty case.
I think they're just too careful. I think that that atmosphere is, as we found it, is changing, and changing rather materially. That there for a long while, every security officer, every agency head, passed on every loyalty and security case as if Senator McCarthy were looking right over his shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
With Senator McCarthy's censure by the Senate, with his loss of influence and prestige, I think that that has made a great deal of difference in, as I put it, in the atmosphere in which the Loyalty Security Program is being run. It's a fascinating subject when you get into it, and it's also, and I use the word advisedly, it's a hellish problem. How we protect ourselves against somebody who wants to subvert our government and still maintain our American liberties. In other words, not fall for the checks and brainwashing, in effect, thought control that the communists would instill themselves. It's not a simple thing by any manner of means.
No, it's far from simple, and I don't think that the guilt by kinship condemnation should be regarded as simple in itself either, because after all, speaking from an entirely different point of view, I think, than what you've expressed. After all, if a man is in close association with his parents, and those parents have been subverted, they are in a position to bring a certain amount of pressure on him to, if necessary, spy on his movements. And calling a man a security risk, that is when it's taken in the pure sense of the word, which it isn't always, is not necessarily an indictment of his own loyalty, but rather the sort of, that he is a sensitive individual, a weak link, someone who might be gotten to. And I think that this parentage or close relationship business is just as real a point as the one that's been made many times. A man is an alcoholic, or his associates are of improper character or something like that. He subjects himself to blackmail. I believe that the parentage business is of the same category.
Well, in each of these cases, they have said, I think they have said, correct me if I'm wrong, I think they have said that the man himself had showed no evidence of disloyalty, but his mother or his father, whatever.
It's not
that
he's disloyal. That's the whole point. The matter of security risk and disloyalty constantly gets tangled up. I don't mean just around this table here. I mean wherever it's expressed, whether it's in...
Well, if his commission is to be held up...
in this particular case, you're quite right, it's confused sometimes, it's not confused now.
Shouldn't the halt be called ahead of time? Now, you're taking the Landy case. If they were going to withhold that commission, which they did, Why subject that young man to putting on a uniform and standing up there with all of his classmates with arms upraised taking the oath of office while he's forced to stand there with his arms by his side as all the cameras click and have the pictures publicized all over the country?
Well, I don't think the That's publicity was asked for by the Navy.
No, but I mean they're subjecting a man unnecessarily to...
It seems to me they could have left him in the barracks.
Yes,
sure.
He should have been screened well in advance.
Yes, that was the whole point.
Screened as an applicant or even screened while he was in officer's candidate school. That was the time for the screening. I think that has been corrected to a certain extent because under the Eisenhower program, all of our government employees were rechecked. That's been all but completed. And from now on, they'll check new applicants coming in. Bill, one point that you made there raises a question in my mind. That is, I think it's unfair, and it's worked to the absolute hurt of people to lump together loyalty and security cases. A fellow might be perfectly loyal, yet if he insists on having that third martini and blabbers at a cocktail party, he's a security risk.
Sure.
And probably should not be with the government. I don't defend that at all. But I think by lumping together loyalty and security, we've come to a point anybody who is fired or anybody who leaves the federal government is now open to very real suspicions, A, about his loyalty, and B, about his personal life. I think that the administration should come to some simple term like suitability. You're not suitable for federal employment. And hire and fire on that basis. Because a lot of people have literally been smeared. Their chances of livelihood have been greatly jeopardized. The families of people have been hurt in some of these bad cases that have gone sour. I think suitability would be a much fairer and a much more accurate definition.
I agree with you 100%, but as soon as you start broadening the classification there and merely saying that a man is unsuitable, then you run into the counter-objection that here the charges are too vague. And that a man who has maybe just had his throat cut politically is ousted for some reason like suitability.
Well, but remember, any one of the four of us sitting at this table can be let go by the National Broadcasting Company for one simple reason. We're unsuitable for further employment by NBC. The reason may be A, B, C, or D. But at least we'd leave NBC. And you say, well, we didn't get along.
They didn't think we were any good.
That's all right.
Crime
but boy,
about
these
that.
Government workers, a lot of them have been really. There's been a bar sinister put over their lives.
Oh, sure.
Let's turn for the moment here to the good old subject of politics. You know, last week we were saying that the Republicans seemed to be singing this theme about it's either Ike or no one. The Democrats, however, it would seem, have no such one-man political show, even if Mr. Stevenson is the man most mentioned. The political gossip is that he can get the nomination next year in Chicago, but only after a battle. He certainly doesn't have the solid party support that Mr. Eisenhower seems to enjoy. But the Democrats appear to have a formidable list, more formidable perhaps if President Eisenhower chooses not to oppose them personally. But there is, as we've said, Mr. Stevenson, who will set out soon on the political train, make some major speeches in some major cities, but who will wait at least until November before making known his intentions. For him, the draft days are over. If he wants it, I think he'll have to go after it. So it is also with New York's Governor Harriman, who at this point has the support of Tammany's boss, Carmine DiSapio. In the realm of speculation, there's talk that DiSapio will watch closely the reaction to Mr. Stevenson when Stevenson visits New York for one of those $100 a plate dinners. If reaction is highly favorable, Mr. DiSapio might well switch bandwagons. Incidentally, there's some interesting rivalry now existing between DiSapio and the Democrats' elder statesman, Harry S. Truman. Mr. Truman attempted, obviously, to take DiSapio down a peg or two when, in commenting on DiSapio's political powers, Mr. Truman offered the observation that DiSapio was no kingmaker in Missouri. But to go on with these candidates, besides Stevenson and besides Harriman, we can't overlook the coonskin cap of Estes Kefauver, but the odds seem against him. At least that's my opinion. He has a big following, but if he couldn't make it in 52, I don't think it seems likely he can succeed in 56, because he arrived at the 52 conventions fresh from his televised crime hearings, which brought him immense popularity, and he'll have difficulty trying to get the same popular reaction from Dixon Yates. Well, these three would seem to be the front runners. There are others, California's Governor Knight, for example, who could be compromised candidates, but who certainly would need a build-up a la Wendell Willkie as far as the voters are concerned. One more comment here. The guess is none of them wants to face Ike. They'd all prefer to wait another 4 years. Anybody to add to the list?
Well, Kefauver certainly lost two votes, Dixon's and Yates's. Yeah.
Harriman would be pretty old to run in 56. I don't mean 56. I mean...
In 60, he would be.
Yeah, he would be well...
He's 67 now, isn't he?
No, I think he's 64 now.
64 now?
The gossip I've heard is that Governor Leader of Pennsylvania and Governor Minor of New Jersey, both of them young Republicans, or rather Democrats, excuse me, sirs, are sort of quietly rooting for Mr. Stevenson to get the nomination this time in the complete confidence that he will be licked, thereby taking him out of the field. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And thereby taking him out of the field, and Harriman's eliminated because of age. And whether they have Mr. Knight in mind, I don't know. But anyway, that's the scuttlebutt from New Jersey and Pennsylvania.
See, Knight is in his 50s, isn't he?
I would guess so.
I'm sure. Pretty vigorous.
I'm sure that the Democrats are not consulting with Harold Stassen about whom they should nominate next year. But Stassen has a feeling that the Democratic ticket will be Governor Harriman in New York, and then Governor Sophie Williams of Michigan for vice president, which would make a pretty good ticket. I don't think they'd beat Eisenhower. Incidentally, the Democrats, I understand, are coming up with a new campaign slogan, which will be, "You never had it almost as good."
The Republicans are promoting, what is it, everything is booming but the guns?
Yes, that's one of theirs.
But all this talk about you can't beat Ike, it puts the Democratic Party in the position of the football coach who, when asked to comment on the season, said, "Well, we're going to show up for every game." And everybody seemed to think if Ike runs, that's it. He'll have no... The Republicans will have no difficulty.
No, but it's interesting that Senator Jenner raised a little point. There's no more Republican than Bill Jenner of Indiana. And while he just takes it for granted that the president can have a second term, he said that even with those wonderful Eisenhower coattails next year, that he thought that the farm vote probably would cost the Republicans Congress. From the Republican state chairman who were here last week, I think it's very plain that this farm vote has them deeply worried, much more worried than any politician ever will admit. It's, farm income went down another 4 points in the first 6 months of this year, and it looks as if it'll go down some more. And we all remember what happened in 1948, when everybody was so sure that Tom Dewey was going to be the next president, including Tom Dewey, and Iowa, of all states, went Democratic. I think by nomination time, you may find pretty good fight on in the Democratic Party. You don't normally let a nomination for president go by default.
Well, bringing up the name of Senator Kefauver brings to mind the fact that the congressional junketers went scrambling over to Moscow this summer in the way that was a caution. Senator Kefauver along with him. I don't know exactly what you'd say broke the ice. Geneva, of course, but the immediate trigger may have been that episode in Yugoslavia when our one-time colleague Jack Begon and Frank Kelly of the New York Herald Tribune sounded out a very convivial Mr. Khrushchev just after a cocktail party and got their invitation to go. The fact that these two reporters were able to get a visa into Russia so easily may have given others the idea. Anyways, we all know members of Congress soon after that began putting in their applications, and at one juncture, 44 lawmakers were behind the Iron Curtain at one clip. These trips are...
There are more members of Congress in Russia than there were in Washington.
Well, sure. Of course, these trips are put down as necessary education, the senators and representatives maintaining that they can produce much better legislation when it pertains to Russia than if they've actually seen the place and know something of the people and the landscape. All so-called junkets are excused on that basis, and to a greater or lesser extent, I suppose, that's entirely justified. However, I'm afraid there may be grounds for suspicion that in the case of these tourists to the Soviet Union, a lot of plain old curiosity and spirit of adventure may have figured in the planning. These tourists from Capitol Hill have reported back varyingly on their experiences. Some found everything as nice as pie. A couple of them returned in a very sour frame of mind because one of them had been given a hard time by a young Red Army lieutenant who held a cocked revolver at the distinguished gentleman's head for an hour. The question is, exactly what benefit can a congressman hope to gain by visiting Russia at this stage of the game? Does it appear that these junketers are finding out much that they couldn't get from a State Department pamphlet or from the newsreels? Arthur?
Well, I think there is plenty to be gained through personal contact. I if they can go over there and talk to Bulganin and talk to Khrushchev and, more or less get down to brass tacks, it's much better than simply going through a third person at the State Department. I'm reminded of a story that Senator Ellender tells about being behind the Iron Curtain and about how the State Department more or less tried to block him from seeing one of the foreign ministers over there. He got to see him and took along two young men from the State Department for the conversations, which lasted 2 hours. And when they came out, the young fellows, who are assigned to the country, said they learned more in those 2 hours than they had learned in the previous 6 months. Because this is the first time they had close, intimate contact with the rulers in these countries, with the leaders. I think it's altogether necessary.
I started this by bringing up the subject of education. I'd like to stand four square in favor of educated congressmen, including whatever information they might pick up on these junkets.
Well, now, what about the question of misinformation that they pick up? I mean, under the optimum circumstances, in the case of Senator Ellender, as recited, here was a case where he developed information that the State Department people accepted as being true. On the other hand, working under the language handicap, contacting individuals who are on their home ground and sure of themselves, isn't it a good chance that a congressman could be badly misled? Now, I'm not saying that Senator Malone was misled. That's not my intention at all. But Senator Malone was right in the van hollering for the Russian scalp not too long ago, and yet his visit to Russia seems to have changed his entire outlook. And whether his outlook was changed on a solid basis or whether it was changed because somebody might have sold him a bill of goods or something, I can't testify to, and time will have to prove out. But it just shows that a man with very deep-seated opinions can't have those opinions changed in a hurry, and my wonderment is whether or not those are, whether or not they do maybe get misled by that sort of contact.
Well, I think the chances are no greater, the chances of being misled are no greater in Moscow than they are in Washington.
No, and I'm sure that even though our Russian friends are putting on their best Dale Carnegie course act over there, I think that's a pretty good description of it, that this first-hand look, and there's Malone, who, as you said, has been with Joe McCarthy on everything. Now, George Malone's not coming back pro-communist at all.
No.
But he has finally seen that the Russians are in control of their people, that this is no short run that we're in, that the Russian threat is going to be with us, as Admiral Radford's been trying to tell those gents on Capitol Hill for 40 to 50 years. And I would think that Malone is a better legislator than he was before he went to Moscow, and I think that applies to John Sparkman, as does Keith Harvey and the whole crowd. I'm for it.
So am I.
The more these congressmen travel, I'm very happy to pay my very small share there. Of their expenses. I'm only a little jealous of their trips. I'd love to take the trip and have the access to those foreign dignitaries that they have.
Another man with a change of view is Charlie Halleck from Indiana. He came back today saying we got to continue foreign aid. He'd been over and had seen what it had done in the European economic situation. They did a complete reversal.
No.
Well,
I think it's good. I think it's broadening.
Well, people complain often about the cost of it. Comparatively, actually, it costs very little compared to a
percentage-wise,
very small.
Sure.
And might save money in the long run if people were sufficiently well-informed to spot instances of waste and whatnot in foreign aid and that sort of thing. I mean, Mr. Halleck, having witnessed foreign aid projects firsthand, much better position to decide whether so-and-so is necessary or whether it's just some bureaucrat's idea of a good thing to spend money on.
I think the coining of the word junket is unfortunate.
Yeah, I do, too.
You have been listening to Keys to the Capitol, a transcribed informal discussion of events and issues in Washington. Tonight you've heard these four NBC Washington reporters: David Brinkley, Richard Harkness, Arthur Berrio, and Bill Sprague. Listen again next week at this same time to Keys to the Capitol. This program has come to you from Washington. This is the NBC Radio Network.